Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Rest is History. It's a very, very special episode today because we just have a series of treats for you. Treat number one, Tom Holland is not present. So don't stop listening. In fact, more people will listen. People will hear the rumors, the word will spread, and they'll be like, God, I've got to listen to that bonus episode. So that's good news. Good news number two, Theo's not present, is he? His car is having an MOT. He's in the garage. He's actually listening to this now because everyone thinks the presenters of The Rest is History are total control freaks. And there's some truth in that. But Theo is such a control freak that he's dialing into this bonus episode from the garage on his 4G because he doesn't trust his colleagues, shall we say, to do their job adequately. So what's the other good news? We are joined today by Her Grace the Duchess of Marlborough herself, Tabitha Syrett, who is the assistant producer of The Rest is History, and very excitingly, former Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith in his Asquith t-shirt. So that is James Regan, our community manager. Now, the instruction that we always get from our executive producers is don't make the bonus inside baseball. In other words, don't make it all about the podcast, make it about history. But we will talk a little bit about the podcast today, won't we?
Yeah.
So maybe I will start with Tabby, since you're the real boss. So Tabby, is this your first time on the speaking?
This is my first time on air.
So exciting.
Yeah. I think this is what I was made for.
Yeah, definitely. So you have been with The Rest is History for how long?
I think now 9 months.
Right.
But it's flown by.
9 glorious months.
Gone in the blink of an eye. 9 glorious months.
Yeah. You were very nervous, I can remember, when you joined, because I can remember seeing you on the screen.
I was very nervous. I was overawed.
Theo said, Tabby will be joining us. But he said it in a very... He didn't actually explain who you were or anything like that. He just said it in his usual kind of hangdog...
Just a fan.
Yeah, hangdog way. So how did you get to work for Goalhanger and to The Rest is History?
Well, I had been, truth be told, something of a fan.
Oh.
But I mean, you know, no more than I was a fan of sort of History Hit.
Oh no, Tabby, don't say that.
No, I was a huge, huge fan. And then I saw an email come through with roles open.
Yeah.
And I leapt at the opportunity. I'm pretty sure I wrote an adoring, longing letter to...
Did you?
I did.
Did I reply?
You very kindly replied, but I'm so glad that it made such a marked impression on you.
Oh, well, I get them all the time, you see.
So. Yeah, of course. Exactly. I knew it'd be one of a million.
And so you're in charge of, basically, you listen to all the episodes when we're doing them.
Yes.
And you do a lot of the editing, don't you?
I do. But I'm not sure I want that getting out to the public at large because I'm going to have to start taking responsibility for a lot of the abuse that Theo gets.
Oh, yeah. For the cutting. Poor old Theo.
Yeah. The truth is revealed. Theo's been innocent all along.
Yeah. And then Mr. Asquith. So this is James Regan. So James, you basically run the Discord, don't you? And you run the club, the Rest is History Club, which obviously is so dear to our hearts. How did you get into doing that? Because you were a teacher. You were a history teacher. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I used to teach a noble secondary school in Norfolk. And I was just coming to the end of my time there. I was moving south to relocate to be with my partner, now wife. And I was doing MA at King's when the pandemic struck. And so whilst I was at home a lot, I decided to get interested in online communities and things like that.
Interested in online communities? Tabby's laughing in there.
What does that mean?
I mean, for The Rest is History, it's just being a point of contact for our beloved listeners and especially our subscribers.
Yeah.
They are your empire.
I'm a Pontifex Maximus between the talent and the people.
So Theo, from his garage, is just sending you loads of abuse in the chat. And he's cross that you haven't used the words chat community.
Or first wife.
Yes. That is very harsh, Theo. So to give people a sense, so when we started The Rest is History, Tom and me, in 2020, I mean, Goalhanger Podcasts was two people. There was a separate films division that dealt with the We Have Ways Second World War podcast. But then it was Tony Pastor and Jack Davenport who were basically running it out of, you know, a shed or whatever. And now Goalhanger is pretty big. You have how many people working in the offices?
25, I think.
Yeah. And history. So the history team is pretty tight, though.
Yes.
There's Theo. There's you, Tabby. obviously Mr. Asquith.
Yeah. Then we have Jack, who edits the videos and does all the YouTube stuff.
A band of brothers.
A cult, if you will.
Yeah. But you have this sort of, to give people a sense, you have this big open plan office. So you've got Rest is Politics, you have Empire, the We Have Ways team. Who else have you got? Rest is Money, Rest is Entertainment. Basically, a lot of spin-offs of the Rest is History.
Yeah.
So, Tabby, as you're doing the editing, does it sometimes drive you mad when basically the schedule says Tom and Dominic are going to do two episodes about, you know, Martin Luther or something? And then when we actually go into the record, we're like, oh, Tabby, it's actually going to be seven or whatever.
I haven't got there yet because I am genuinely a very big fan of the show.
Oh, Tabby.
And I enjoy the recording so much. I enjoy hearing you and Tom speak and everything. So, I mean, yeah, latterly, maybe I pull my hair out. But at the time, I'm always pretty pleased.
Yeah, of course. And James, did you listen to The Rest is History before you joined Goalhanger?
I actually did, yes.
You did?
Yes.
So Theo was asking me to ask you about Persian Fire.
Oh, God.
What's the story with Persian Fire?
It's a lovely anecdote.
So this is Tom Holland's book about the Greco-Persian Wars.
Thank you, Theo. When I was very serious getting into ancient history, I went to Waterstones and I was just trying to hoover up any books I could find. The hardback of Persian Fire had just come out, so it was proudly displayed.
Yeah.
And I think I finished it in about 3 days and had to find Rubicon.
Wow.
That altered my kind of historical leanings. Previous to that, obviously, I'd been very much a 20th century guy. And then
Tudor history.
Oh, never. Oh, ugh.
You don't like the Tudors?
Oh, they're fine.
So disparaging.
They're fine. Thomas More is, of course, a man for all seasons, but a lot of Tudors are very forgettable.
Right. Okay. What's your view on this, Tabby?
I'm quite a big fan of Cromwell. Has to be said.
I knew you were sound, Tabby. Well done. Very good.
Thank you very much.
So, James, then you went and taught history, right? What did you teach when you were teaching history?
Everything from 1066, although I must say, when I had a bit more control, I did try and push it back.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did Greeks and Romans. And then, yes, of course, you do things like the Reformation and you can't not do World War II. Yeah, just a kind of gamut, really.
What's the best? What's the best to teach? What do you think the kids like most and is most effective at teaching them history?
I think medicine. Mm-hmm. So through time, it covers such a broad span whilst engaging human interest, which I think is a foundation to any good history.
Okay. It's very trendy among academics, history of medicine, isn't it?
It was a big thing at Edinburgh. And people chose it because they thought it would kind of be a DOS, and it never was.
Well, you know why it's so trendy? It's because there's loads of money. Because there's loads of grant funding. There's like the Wellcome Institute and stuff like that. They're throwing money at academics to write about it.
But why is that? Why are people throwing money at it?
I don't know. I think there's just research. It's become very fashionable because of Wellcome and whatnot. There are institutes set up to promote that particular area of history. It's kind of trendy. You can do a lot of kind of abstract noun history. Mm. I mean, I remember when I was teaching at Sheffield, it was like the big thing. There were like specialist historians of medicine. The courses recruited really well. There was like a big growing literature in it, all that sort of stuff. We've actually never done it on The Rest of this History, have we? 500 episodes.
No.
Shocking.
Yeah. So, Tabby, did you do history?
I did classics and I did divinity.
You're very Tom Holland.
Absolutely. I'm kind of a Frankenstein creation of all of Tom Holland's favorite things.
Oh, my word. That I did not know.
Yeah. A great honor.
Yeah.
And it was actually thanks to reading Dominic's book, Who Dares Wins?
Oh.
And through listening to the rest of history. Yeah, genuinely, that I grew to really love more modern history.
Right.
Like, I was taught the Cold War very badly. And then in later life, I came to think it was absolutely fascinating. The Falklands War, probably one of my favourite Rest is History series ever.
This muses my ears, Tabby. So glad you've come to Goalhanger. I agree with you, actually. I think modern history can often be taught quite boringly. I think the Cold War particularly is often very boring. I mean, it's all detente, missile, details of arms control talks. No one cares about that. I mean, I know some people do, but it's actually intrinsically quite dull and quite technical and undramatic. And I think it could be done in a much more exciting way.
It's too departed, I think, at school from the things that I think are so exciting, which is when it kind of runs as close as it can possibly be while still being history to sort of fantasy, which is why people love the medieval world.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, you know, the Tudors. But there always seems to be something that's slightly in vogue. What do you think, Dominic, is the great historical subject that's in vogue right now?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, it depends who you're talking about, whether you're talking about in vogue among consumers of history. And actually, that doesn't really change. I think the Tudors is obviously always massively popular because of the soap opera element.
The Nazis.
Yeah. I think people have an inexhaustible appetite for the Nazis. Listen, our own download figures bear that out.
Yeah.
And actually, if you talk to anybody in publishing, they will say, you know, we could publish a book on the Nazis. And we know there's a floor below which that book will not fall. It will sell X thousand copies. Equally, you can publish the most brilliant book on, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Oh.
Great favorite of our chat community.
And we support that.
Yeah, of course. But there's a ceiling above which that will not rise. People just will not be persuaded to buy a book on it. And I think those perennial topics are always very popular with the readers of history or the listeners or whatever. But in terms of the people making history, so historians themselves, actually it tends to be very modish, I would say, like what's fashionable. So right now, if I was applying for a grant, you know, if I was an academic and I wanted 2 years research leave, and I wanted to guarantee that I would get the leave, irrespective of the quality of the work, I would say, listen, I'm doing a thing about gender identity among migrants in the 17th century or whatever.
Yeah.
And I would just be ticking all those boxes and the climate change implications of it. And the grant body, because this is the way that kind of box tickers work, they would be brilliant. He's hitting all the points. And that means that people do tailor their research to kind of the concerns of the day. And I'm not saying that in a sort of golf club way, because that's actually always been the way. You know, in the 1970s, the period that I've written about, the kind of history that people did was all like labor history. It was all the trade unionism and stuff like that would seem now really dated.
Yeah.
And people would be slightly bewildered by it. But it just kind of comes and goes in waves. What's James Regan writing? Tabby is great at turning the questions back on the questioner. Be careful, Dominic. Are you Tabby? Is that your skill?
This is sacrilege.
Dominic, have you not noticed every time you've asked a question, yeah, Tabby will very quickly say something and then flip it round so you talk.
James, I want to ask you, how does that make you feel?
This is why Tabby is such a much-loved member of the Rest is History community. Now, I'll tell you the best thing that a producer has ever said to a Rest is History presenter, neither of them are here, or one of them's in the garage. It was when we were going around Australia and New Zealand, and poor old Theo had basically said, I think it was just to make Tom feel comfortable, he brought Dominion with him. I was reading Dominion, and every now and again, I'd look at Theo on the plane or whatever, and he'd be reading, and he'd just be like sighing, looking out of the window. You know, he clearly have just got on about a couple of pages. And Tom kept saying to him very eagerly, Theo, how are you getting on with it? And then Theo made the mistake one day of being, we were in, like, I don't know, Melbourne or something, and he hadn't progressed very far, and he clearly was massively becalmed inside this book. As Tom said, how are you doing? And Theo said, it's fine, but I feel the point has been made.
Theo did say that his profound Catholicism,
yeah,
which he carries with him wherever he goes, he did say that reading Dominion did give him a more profound understanding of the world.
Wow, Theo, that's nice. So if Theo listening to this in the garage, steaming because he's being talked about behind his back.
He can't defend.
Exactly, exactly. So just before we get into some bonus questions and all that sort of stuff, James, explain to the listeners why you love Asquith so much. What's all that about?
Well, dear listeners, I will paint a scene for you. It was not long after I'd joined this illustrious company, and it was my first live stream, mm-hmm, and I was at home listening with my wife, Dominic Sandbrook, taking us to the top 10 prime ministers of Britain.
That's right, yeah.
And, well, I can only describe it as a very polemical list. As we got to number 6,
yeah,
H.H. Asquith had made it somehow onto the list of top prime ministers of Great Britain.
It's a great prime minister.
I mean, he has moral as well as political failings.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of abuse that you were. You and Dom Johnson, our erstwhile Supreme Commander, you were both giving me a lot of grief about the choice of Asquith. I was getting texts while I was doing this saying, massive nonce and stuff.
This is a great debate.
Yeah. But you gave me so much grief that we just thought it was amusing. Basically, to try and get Asquith into every podcast and to mention how much of an admirer of his you are. And actually, you are wearing right now your H.H. Asquith t-shirt, which I'm delighted to see.
He wears it most days.
You wore it at their Christmas dinner, didn't you?
I did, to our lovely Christmas dinner. And before even pleasantries had been passed, Dominic Sandbrook just threw this black mass at me, and it turned out it was this t-shirt, and he said, wear it now.
Yeah, you had a suit, but the task with t-shirts over the summer. It was a great look.
It was very warm. And I wore it for the rest of the day.
Of course you did. Of course you did. Well, that was a very fun evening, the Christmas evening.
It was.
For both of you, that was your first, was that first big kind of event as a team, social events as a team altogether. And it was very successful, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
A lot of stuff was left behind at the pub, as I recall.
Yes.
Including Tony's credit card, I think.
Tony's credit card. Yeah, very poor.
Yeah. Your coat.
My coat.
And what dignity we had left.
Exactly so. And Jack said to me a week or so afterwards, somehow the subject of you, James, came up. And Jack, who was clearly very impressed by your conduct, said, James Regan's a top lad. He's a top lad. So... The best thing is that Tabby and Theo call you Asquith now when you're not around. They just refer to you routinely on when we're talking about, Theo's like, oh, I've got a message from Asquith.
Well, we're sure we'll be understood.
Dear listeners, I should explain a peculiarity of how we talk to one another. Because, of course, when you say, you see that person over there you hate with a great passion, that's your mate, that is. That's what's happening here. You know, I said I didn't rate Asquith, so Dominic has now made it his life mission to constantly refer to him.
Exactly. Right. So we should answer some questions. So let me start with one more question to each of you. An idea for a Rest Is History series that Tom and I have never mentioned. So something that will surprise me and Tom, but you would love to see us do. Mr. Asquith.
I would love to see a series very much in the vein of Luther, but Thomas More, I think, is an incredibly fascinating man. That bridges different worlds. And there's so many kind of diving off points.
Well, the good news is we're doing this show at Hampton Court in the early summer, aren't we? And we're definitely going to be talking about Thomas More in the show at Hampton Court. So for listeners who haven't got their tickets already, who want to go, definitely look into doing that. There's a big sort of Hampton Court Palace festival, isn't there?
Huge thing. It can be a whole day thing.
Exactly. Tom Jones is there and the rest is history.
Headlining with Jesse J.
Yeah, who would have thought it? So, Tabby, do you have your notion yet?
I do. I think it wouldn't be very cheery, but I just think it's sort of a darkly fascinating subject. And that is the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot.
Cool. That would be very good. Yeah. I would very much like to do that.
It is grim, though. Yeah.
That is a grim subject.
Mm. I went and saw it all in Cambodia.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And it was one of the more sort of harrowing, but certainly impactful days of my life.
They have kind of museums with piles of skulls and stuff, don't they, famously?
Yeah, you walk around it. I mean, it's kind of, it is chilling. I mean, then I read a book about it and it was just something I had no idea about. Sort of, it wasn't that spoken about in the West at the time because journalists obviously weren't allowed into the country or out. Mm-hmm. And I was so surprised at having always liked history, the massive period of history I just knew nothing about.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those periods of history, isn't it, where you don't say it's good, but I think it's important that you look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't leave feeling good.
No. I mean, you'd be weird if you did, right? And when you were teaching, did you sometimes feel you had to... So with the younger ones, did you have to shield them from stuff or did you not really...
Yeah. I think there's a great balance.
Yeah.
You want to protect them from the worst of humanity, but at the same time, you want to be aware. Mm-hmm. I think it's a case of scaling up. So when you're in year seven and you talk about the harrowing of the North... You know, you might say there was lots of killing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't condone that, but, you know, this is what happens in... Gosh,
so woke. Yeah.
Proudly. But yeah, I mean, by the time you get to year nine, it's compulsory to have taught, you know, the transatlantic slave trade. And so at that point, I think you just have to come in with enough kind of disclaimers and maturity and just say, look, this is what it is. This is what happened. You need to know these things.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would never alter history for sensibility.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about us. Dominic.
Okay.
Let's get to some questions.
Go on.
So, Peter Sarkis. Excellent series on the Titanic. Absolutely gripping. Read the myth that immediately became celebrated afterwards. Were the survivors themselves the main sources for these?
The survivors definitely did tell stories, Peter, and indeed Tabby. They were interviewed straight away. They told contradictory stories, as you would expect, because it's all very chaotic and everybody has their own different interpretation of what happened. So that's where you get a lot of the different stories about Captain Smith or about the fate of Murdoch or all those things. Mm. So yes, obviously the survivors are the main source because where else are you going to get the stories from? But the thing is that in the week after it sank, there was so much disinformation in the newspapers. I mean, most famously, You know, I was actually just looking at it the other day when I was picking the images that we would use on social media to promote the episode. The newspaper headlines that say Titanic 6, everybody saved.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were loads of myths flying around straight away. And it's been impossible to correct them, I would say. I mean, actually, the most pernicious myth and the most long-lasting, I don't want to return to inside baseball, but our executive producer, Tony Pastor, is a keen believer in this because I've heard reports that he's been dissing the series in the office because he says we're too easy, too soft on the first class passengers. Mm. And he says, oh, it's terrible that the first class passengers escaped in higher numbers than the second and third class. And the reason, I'm addressing this to Tony, the reason the first class passengers escaped is not because they were given priority. That is absolutely not the case. It is because they're very close to the boat deck. Far closer than third class. Third class, the gates, remember, are not open for about 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Not because of prejudice, but because the gates are there and because in the furore, people don't think to open them as quickly as they should have done. So the first class are right there. The first class, I would say, they're traveling in slightly smaller groups and they are more socially confident, obviously. Mm. So in other words, getting on the boat, Lady so-and-so gets on the boat and thinks, well, obviously my husband is still on the Titanic. But there's no doubt in her mind that she will be reunited with him at some point. And although she's lost some of her possessions, okay, it's very annoying, but it's not the end of the world. The thing is, if you're a third class passenger, you're probably traveling in a group, maybe with family members. That's why so many third class families did not survive, because people didn't want to lose or leave their family members. They're obviously nervous. They are unsettled by being on a ship at all. Mm. They don't know what to do. The thought of getting into a lifeboat fills them with terror. There are lots of these stories about third-class passengers getting into the lifeboats and then getting out again because they'd rather stay on the ship. If you're traveling with, you know, a big family, you're perhaps not going to go off on your own.
Yeah.
There are all these different reasons, plus the issue of distance. So the idea that it is just naked prejudice and snobbery is just plain wrong. It is just totally and utterly wrong. But that myth, like so many of these myths, it's ineradicable.
Yeah.
You know, we could record 1,000 podcasts on the Titanic and people could publish 1,000 books on it. And don't forget, our podcasts on the Titanic are dependent on the existing scholarship. It's not like we're saying anything that hasn't been said, but people will always believe them. So, yeah, I think the myths will be with us forever. Just on the survivors, if you go onto YouTube, you can see some amazing, there's been loads of them on Twitter and things since the series went out. And people have been sending Tom and me links to these interviews with survivors like in the 1960s and 1970s.
Amazing.
Some of them are really, really moving. So there's one that was done of the guy who, I think he was the assistant purser. He does this big interview. It's about the 1970s. And he's quite chipper. You know, he talks about the sinking and stuff, but he's not like, people didn't in those days, obviously, when they're talking about things. They prized resilience so much, they wouldn't start crying on camera.
Yeah.
And right at the end of the interviewer says to him, how do you feel? You know, is it very traumatic reliving it in an interview like this? And this bloke says, well, I'll probably have nightmares tonight. And he says it quite matter-of-factly, with almost quite wryly.
Yeah, I bet.
He's like 80 or something. He says, oh, I'll probably have a nightmare tonight. And he says, you'd think I wouldn't, because you think when you're old, you grow out of it. But you don't. I have nightmares about being on Titanic, and the whole thing comes back to me. I'll have it till the day I die. And you sort of think, wow.
Yeah, and that's somehow much more impactful coming from a man like that in a time like that. Mm. The story in the series about, was it Ismay?
Yes, yeah.
Who later in life, his granddaughter spoke about, you know, the big train accident. I mean, that was, that really, really struck me.
Yeah, especially because he's got the guilt, which other people don't have. I mean, other people have survivor's guilt, which people who survive disasters always have. You know, I lived and other people died. And why me, kind of thing. And the trauma of the evening. But he, on top of that, has two things. One, the public
censure, yeah.
A public censure, exactly, especially from America. Plus, it's his ship. So thousands of people died on his ship, and he feels, you know, you'd be inhuman if you didn't feel a degree of responsibility. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, next question, Tabby.
Next question. Okay. So, this is from Klusks. For Dominic, in Seasons in the Sun, you say the percentage of people who felt there were important differences between Labour and the Tories went from 71% to 68%. to 59% in 1964 to 50% in 1979.
So this starts in 1945 and goes down to 1979.
Yeah.
And basically, the people who thought there were massive differences narrowed enormously.
Yeah. Are there any obvious explanations for this?
It's a very detailed question. I love it. Are there obvious explanations for this drop? Well, the weird thing, of course, is that in 1979, there are very important differences between Labour and the Tories, because the Tories are led by Margaret Thatcher at that point.
Yeah.
I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, there's definitely a disillusionment with politics. And I don't think that necessarily reflects the state of the country so much as it's a massive decline in deference, a decline in trust in institutions and authority. Mm. And that's not just in Britain, but you see a very similar thing, for example, in the US. If you look at polls in the US in the 60s and 70s, trust in institutions, they fall. And people always say this is because of Vietnam and Watergate. But actually, the trouble is that historians of different countries don't really talk to each other, because the same thing happens in Britain, and there's no Vietnam War in Britain. So I think the reason is that actually is you have a much more affluent, individualistic, highly educated population. They become much less deferential and much less respectful of authority. In a weird way, that's what you want. That's what you've created, because you've had all these people at university. You've said to them, think for yourselves. Don't just do what you're told.
Yeah.
But then when people say, well, I'm going to think for myself, I think all our politicians are morons, then people say, oh dear, very sad, you know, rise of populism. So I think what happens is that people became much more distrustful of politics more generally. And I mean, I think people had always actually had a healthy skepticism. But the other thing that goes hand in hand with that is that the very, very strong sense of class polarization in Britain began to decline because as the economy boomed in the 50s and 60s, people were much more mobile. They're moving between classes. So the idea of like Labour, the working man's party, the Tory party, the top hat party, which was still very much the case in 1945. I mean, obviously, that's incredibly simplistic, but as a very broad brush, that's how people thought.
Yeah.
By the 1970s, end of the 1970s, that's become so much more complicated. That I think the idea that like one is the party of the rich, one is the party of the poor, I think that has really corroded, because there are lots of, you know, trade union members who vote Tory in 1979, for example. And there are lots of actually quite affluent, you know, your classic kind of what in American context would be called limousine liberals, you know, your kind of chattering class kind of people.
Yeah.
Who are obviously voting Labour. So the class picture has just become much muddier and more complicated. And I wonder whether that is part of why people don't see the differences. Because the irony, of course, is that in 1979, the policy differences are more stark than at any point since 1945. So it's weird that the public don't see that. But maybe another reason is that Margaret Thatcher in 79 had done a very good job of disguising her more radical instincts. So her manifesto is actually much less radical in 79 than we remember. There's absolutely no sense that unemployment is going to rocket up. There's no talk of privatization, none of these kind of things that we associate with the Thatcher government of the mid-80s. This is amazing, actually, not having Tom here. I could just talk forever and no one... and he doesn't jump in.
But that was definitely something that came across in Who Dares Wins, that in fact she was very cautious.
Yeah, so the interesting thing with her is we'll be doing Mrs. Thatcher, hopefully in 2025, when it'll be the anniversary of her becoming Tory leader. She does have kind of, in inverted commas, radical instincts.
Yeah.
But, and this is what obviously Liz Truss and a lot of her current admirers in conservative politics, I think, get wrong, is that she is really good at politics. And so is therefore pragmatic, flexible. And actually her nickname in some corners of the party was Cautious Margaret in 1979. Now, you never hear talk of that now because it's all the Iron Lady, you know, shouting about socialism and waving a handbag around. But actually at the time, a lot of those radical departures, certainly in economics, she has to be persuaded into them by, you know, her Chancellor Geoffrey Howe and his advisors. She's always very anxious. She's always kind of, okay, let's not rush things. I mean, I was only watching a clip on YouTube the other day, or on the Twitter, I think it was. And it was a writer called Grace Blakely, a kind of very lefty writer who's got a book about capitalism, and was saying, the first thing that Thatcher and Reagan did when they came in the end of the 70s or early 80s was to launch a massive attack on the collective power of the working classes, you know, massive attack on the unions, blah, 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 blah. And I just thought, I mean, that's just not right. It's just wrong. Actually, with the example of Mrs. Thatcher, There'd been all this talk about how to deal with the unions going on in the 60s and 70s. We talked about it in our 1974 episode.
Yeah.
She comes in and actually she's really slow. Instead of having one big bit of legislation to deal with the unions, she has, you know, five or six, which are spaced out over the course of her whole time in office. It's like salami slicing rather than a big package.
Mm.
And that caution really frustrated her supporters in the press and her kind of backbench supporters. Why is she being so slow? Why is she not taking on the unions? It's because she's a really adept practitioner of the politics of the possible. Now, you contrast that with, let's say, Liz Truss. Liz Truss is like, let's do everything straight away in like 3 days. And, you know, who cares if it all falls apart? And dressed up as Mrs. Thatcher and said, this is what the great Margaret Thatcher did. It's just wrong. That's not what she did. Anyway, rant over. Sorry.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't get me started on Asquith. So come on, let's have another question, Tavi. Which one do you fancy?
Right. This is from Wanky Doodle.
Right.
What are the pros and cons of a written constitution? I don't quite understand the British system of a non-codified constitution.
Okay, so the British constitution is not unwritten. People always say it's unwritten, but it's not unwritten. It's just a cumulative constitution, I suppose. So it's a succession of documents and acts of parliament and conventions and stuff that has kind of piled up over the centuries. And what that means is that the British constitution, I mean, people sometimes say, oh, the British have no constitution, they just make everything up. That's not right. There are rules. So for example, when Boris Johnson prorogued parliament.
Yeah, great example.
That was deemed unconstitutional. But it works on precedent, and there's lots and lots of different pieces of paper on which, it, you know, imagine a drawer full. It's like the drawer that Tony Pasta used to have of Rest His History, expenses and receipts. Huge quantities of pieces of paper all piled up in half scrunched up.
But less frightening.
That's how the British Constitution works. The reason we have that is because not since the 17th century have we had a rupture. So there's never been a need to sort of stop and start again, to say, oh, we need to like reboot the system. Certainly not since 1689. Mm. So the countries that have written constitutions tend to have rebooted their system. So the French would be a really good example. They're having, you know, what are they? I can't remember what republic they're on now. Fifth Republic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hold on. I can't believe we're having to do live research.
Oh, it's my first trip to the Bodleian.
Yeah, it's the Fifth Republic. We're on the Fifth Republic. Brilliant. I can't believe we had to Google that. So, you know, we haven't been in that position, so we haven't had to write it all down. Obviously, the paradigmatic example of a country with a constitution where the constitution has taken on this sort of bizarrely outsized role, such that people talk as though they're the only country with a constitution and that theirs is somehow sacred, is the United States.
Mm.
Now, the funny thing is, when I was studying history back near the dawn of time, at university, I did this course. It's called Slavery, Emancipation, and the Crisis of the Union. It was a special subject at Oxford.
God, fascinating.
So this was the thing that you would do, which was your most sort of in-depth bit of historical study. So it's obviously the Civil War and the aftermath and stuff.
Mm.
And my tutor, Lawrence Goldman, used to say to all the students, you know, do you think it should be a written constitution? And he always used to say this. He said, all the students at the beginning of the course say yes. America has a written constitution, it's better than Britain, all that kind of thing, because by definition, you know, 20-year-old students tend to be quite idealistic and sort of, they assume that what other countries do is better than Britain and all that kind of thing. Just almost instinctively, it's the kind of the reflex. And then at the end of the course, he would ask the same question and people would always say no, because you would have learned how a constitution can be a prison. How in that case, the constitution was used by the opponents, for example, of Reconstruction, to limit the new freedoms after the American Civil War granted to the former slaves and so on.
Yeah.
And how a constitution, I mean, obviously, you can end up having massive arguments about the minutiae of a constitution. The most famous example, obviously, is
Second Amendment. Yeah.
Yeah. The right to bear arms in the US.
Yeah.
The sort of the idea of the constitution as sacred actually has become I would argue, a massive albatross. There are lots of things that people say, oh, we can't do that because of the constitution. The Constitution exists to serve you, not you, the Constitution. Now, a lot of people listening to this may say, oh, he doesn't understand our Constitution is very special. Without our Constitution, we're nothing. I don't actually agree with that. Lots of countries don't have the American, I mean, Canada doesn't have the American Constitution. It survives perfectly happily. So personally, I quite like our way of doing it. I think it's obviously not perfect because there is no perfect system. But because I'm quite a sort of small C conservative person, the idea that you have this organic growth, as it were,
yeah,
which can continue changing, right?
There's opportunity. You can repeal outdated rules and conventions.
Of course you can. You can pass a new act of parliament. You can change whatever you like. You can say this piece of paper is wrong. Throw it away, repeal it. You know, can the heir to the throne marry a Catholic or whatever? I mean, we could change that tomorrow. So I think it's not just about what's actually on the pieces of paper. It's actually about your attitude towards them. How much you think this is a living, breathing, changing thing, and how much you think it's set in stone. And I'm not a set in stone person.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we do a couple more?
Yeah, let's do it. Who was the best monarch Britain never had? For instance, John of Gaunt, Robert of Gloucester, the Black Prince.
Best monarch Britain never had. Oliver Cromwell, obviously.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say that.
Come on.
Except I thought you might say Richard Cromwell.
Richard Cromwell. I love Richard Cromwell as well. I think the two of them are a nice, they're a lovely team. They're a nice double act.
Oh, boo.
So you got the hard man coming up front, doing all what needs to be done. They're like Thatcher and Blair, basically.
Oh, God.
Perfect comparison.
Yeah. Who was the best monarch Britain never had?
Lady Jane Grey.
Wow.
Yeah, Lady Jane Grey seems a very impressive person, I think. She's very collected.
She liked her Plato.
Yeah, she's very clever.
Very learned.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm. A serious person.
A serious person. So if you want another serious person, it's actually not a monarch, but kind of is Prince Albert.
Mm.
He's a massively impressive person. John of Gaunt, I mean, all these sort of medieval warlords or magnates, in a weird way, I think they're all kind of much of a muchness.
Except I think maybe John of Lancaster, the Duke of Bedford, who was the younger brother of Henry V, and he was regent while Henry VI was young. And he did a lot of good stuff.
Okay.
He burned Joan of Arc, for one thing.
Brilliant. Love it.
When he got made, I think, sort of the head counselor or whatever it was, he took a pay cut because he wanted to give more money to the army. He was a very competent administrator.
Wow. Okay. God, Tabby. I mean, you've answered the question, if the duo became a trio, which past or present historian would you choose from SJ? You've just answered it with that splendid answer.
Oh, there we go. At last.
Yeah. James, do you have a favourite monarch who wasn't a monarch?
Maybe Henry VIII's brother.
Okay.
How different the world could have been.
Henry VIII's brother, King Arthur Tudor. We don't know much about him.
He was very learned, apparently, well educated.
Yeah, well, he would have been, because obviously Henry VIII is incredibly well educated and with his great enthusiasm for, he's got a great enthusiasm for globes, Henry VIII. he loves a globe.
Does he, Dal?
Yeah, so that's nice. And I'm sure Arthur was the same.
I think he was sort of the soppy foil to Henry VIII's top lad.
I think you only think that, Tabby, because he died.
Mm.
I think that's too harsh. I think everyone thinks that, Arthur. They think sickly.
Exactly. That's what I think, sickly. I think pallid.
No, but I mean, Henry was the young, sensitive man, wasn't he? Because he wasn't groomed for succession, I suppose.
Yeah.
He was a thinker, right?
I don't know that he was sensitive, but he was clever. Yeah, he was definitely clever. I think he was boisterous, though, because there's a story about him when Arthur and Catherine of Aragon get married.
Yeah.
Because I remember putting this in Adventures in Time. It's one of the few facts, few interesting insights we have to Henry VIII as when he's young. He's quite young. He meets Catherine of Aragon and escorts her, first of all, into the city of London when she arrives from Spain.
Yeah.
And then he escorts her, I think, into the cathedral for the actual wedding service. And then they go to the banquet afterwards. Mm. And the story is that he took his nine, I think, and he took his kind of doublet off. So he was just in his shirt. A nine-year-old would do that, right? A nine-year-old at a wedding takes off his tie and sort of undoes his top button and everybody kind of laughs. You know, he's sick of wearing a tie. This is what Henry VIII did.
Yeah.
And then he started dancing really vigorously, kind of jumping around and having fun.
Great japes.
And everybody thought this was very funny. And apparently Henry VII, normally kind of seen as quite chilly and forbidding, sort of counting his tax income, he thinks this is very funny and amusing and like smiles on this.
Yeah.
So definitely young Henry VIII, he's not kind of shy and retiring. Mm. He's good fun. But I think you're absolutely right that one thing we miss about him with all the sort of the wife executing is that he's very bright and he's really interested in ideas and all that sort of thing. I mean, actually, I think Henry VIII gets a bad press. I know he behaves quite poorly on occasion, but he actually doesn't kill that many people by the standards of 16th century monarchs.
I think it's just he got some real big hitters.
Yeah, you're right, Tabby. He kills celebrities. And so people think, oh, he's bloodthirsty. And so people say, the British Stalin. That's rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, he represses rebellions like the Pilgrimage of Grace.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you're a monarch, you kind of have to repress a rebellion. I mean, that's in the job description. He doesn't actually launch massive widespread persecutions.
Yeah.
He's not ludicrously vengeful in a kind of Roman emperor style way. And actually, when he dies, people don't say, oh my God, thank goodness for that. What a terrible king he was. I think by and large, people say he's what a king should be,
yeah.
which is powerful, very fat,
yeah.
very rich, but also impressive. You know, he inspires fear, and that's what a king ought to do.
Yeah.
So this conversation has massively spiraled off. Sorry. Shall we do one more? I'll choose a question for all of us.
All right. One more. Yeah.
So Kat Headley, the last question, or Headley. Which two people from today will be considered a great hero and a great villain in 1,000 years' time? Who wants to go first? Tabby, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. The obvious ones are probably Putin and Zelensky.
Mm-hmm.
But on the whole, I kind of agree with what I think you said before in a bonus, Dominic, which is that I think a lot of people in power, politicians these days, in the future, I think they'll just be footnotes in the annals of history. I think they'll largely be forgotten.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of tepid, kind of unscrupulous, opportunistic populists.
Yeah.
But as a more clear-cut selection, Zelensky and Putin. Two sides of a war.
Okay. Yeah. Very defensible choice. James?
I think it's really tough because 1,000 years is an incredibly long time. And I think just even how we look at history is vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
I think the process is entirely different too. So I don't think we, as you know, Tabby's erudite stated, we don't look at people today and think of them as great men or great women or great people.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's anyone particularly significant to such a degree of infamy that would be worth be called a villain, really.
Okay. I think that's a fair answer because I think it's true that individuals loom much less large in our consciousness now in terms of their power and stuff than they would have done 1,000 years ago, or indeed even 200 or 100 years ago. So funnily enough, the 1,000-year rule puts it into a slightly different perspective than 100 years. If you go back 1,000 years, you know, you'd be in the 1020s or something. How many people from that period are remembered?
Mm.
If you extend the period a bit, either side, you're talking about William the Conqueror.
Yeah.
Canute. There must be some Frankish kings.
Ethelred the Unready.
Ethelred the Unready. Some Byzantine emperors, maybe. A couple of popes. But by and large, when you say remembered, most of those people, of course, are not remembered. They're remembered by people who are really, really interested in history teachers,
yeah,
people who work on historical podcasts, but not the public at large. So, you know, would any American president, how many American presidents will actually be remembered in 1,000 years' time? Washington, obviously the founder. Lincoln.
Yeah.
You know, the Civil War. Roosevelt, World War II.
Kennedy.
But would he, though? So many more people will have been assassinated.
Just because of...
Because of the podcast.
Well, you have to say yes now, Tabby. I mean...
Yeah.
Yes.
I know.
A ringing yes.
See, I don't think Kennedy will be remembered. Who's going to care about the 1960s?
Not even because of the glamour and Camelot.
But it won't seem glamorous. It will seem ludicrous.
For the assassination. It's the conspiracy theory thing. People love it.
But Tabby, it's like me saying to you, King Canute, very glamorous, the style of his North Sea empire.
I quite agree.
But, you know, all of that stuff will seem so distant and so footling and trivial to people. You know, when we're creatures of pure consciousness in 1,000 years' time,
yeah,
the Camelot stuff will just seem, it'll just seem completely bonkers. So going back to the about now, I would say Xi Jinping. What if he's there for 30 years or so?
Yeah.
In the fastest rising power in the world.
That's a good point.
Unless something radical changes, it looks like he will be the leader of China for life.
Mm.
And I think that is a big thing. Whether he will be a hero or a villain, I mean, obviously we don't know. But the way things are going, certainly the Chinese people might well end up remembering him as a hero, as the leader who made them strong again in the world. So he seems to loom pretty large for me. And pains me to say it, but obviously Putin is poised to be the longest running Russian leader since Stalin.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, you know, he's one of those characters people will say of him, in some ways, quite a colorless man, you know, far more flamboyant, glamorous, exciting politicians have come and gone. And he's that kind of chilly, formidable, utterly calculating character who comes up every now and again in history, and you just can't get him out. So I think people will write about him. I think he will matter. I mean, the trouble, of course, for so many Democratic leaders is they're in and out. As gifted as Barack Obama was, he's only there for 8 years. The great characters of history who fascinate biographers tend to, you know, be there for a long time. You get the example of Henry VIII. He's there for decades.
Yeah.
All right.
I've got a question for you.
Go on.
Donnie, what's your favourite class in D&D and why?
My favourite class in D&D?
Yeah.
So remind me what a class is. Is a class like mage and all that stuff? Is that right?
Yeah. He's pretending, dear listener, that he doesn't know.
No. I'll tell you what happened. So Sandbrook Jr. loves all this business. So he made a quest and I was a nobleman.
Yes.
It was like the starting quest that you do when you have the starter pack. So we did that.
Yes.
But actually, James, the role-playing focus has slightly moved on in the household. Because do you know there's a thing called Call of Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft?
Yes.
So this arrived at Christmas, and that is an amazing thing. Oh, my word. That is so cool.
Yeah. It lends itself to storytelling.
Totally it does. Yeah, as well. So, Tabby, I know you probably don't know what this is, all just babble to you. So the Call of Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft stories are kind of written at the turn of the 20th century. They're all about sinister goings-on in New England. You know, like monsters that have been there for generations and stuff. And there's this role-playing game where you basically make up your own stories and stuff. And set in the 1920s and 30s, and there are all different variations of it. So some of them are like adventures in Shanghai or in Weimar Germany or any of these kinds of things. And like the list of, what is it, classes you called them, the list of kind of types of character in that. In Dungeons and Dragons, it's all like goblin,
dwarf,
elf, whatever. Sorry, James, am I being too...
Paladin.
Yeah.
That told you.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. But in Call of Cthulhu, you can be like gangster's mole, speakeasy proprietor.
Private eye.
So it's like history cosplay.
Kind of, except you're not dressing up, although James may well dress up. I don't know. Do you dress up, James, when you play your games?
Not typically.
You could wear your t-shirt. You could dress up as H.H. Asquith. He would be a brilliant character.
Yeah. Disgraced politician.
No, I think the class though is noble lion in political exile, actually, after being stabbed in the back. A founder of welfare state, I believe, is the...
known philanderer.
No. We'll have to do a podcast at some point about Asquith because he's a brilliant character. Sort of incredibly intellectually formidable. As I've told you before, Gladstone used to call him the sledgehammer. When Gladstone was in trouble in debates, he would say, "Bring out the sledgehammer." And someone would say, "Get Mr. Asquith on," because he was brilliant. He was a barrister from Leeds who'd gone to Oxford and was just this fantastic intellect.
Another Balliol man.
Another Balliol man, yeah. Like Peston and Stuart.
All the great men of the modern world.
Yeah. So he took over at the end of the first decade, led the Liberal government. You know, he's going to come up when we do our First World War series.
Yeah.
Because we're thinking about doing thing on the origins of the First World War. And the first months of the First World War. And I have to be careful that he doesn't take over the whole, because obviously he's so charismatic that he'll end up taking over the whole series. Right. Do you know, that's a good idea. James, I've seen in the chat, you've suggested that we do a series about H.P. Lovecraft and the history of horror.
I think that would be really, really interesting because it's so influenced by life in the early 20th century.
Mm.
There's questions of immigration and eugenics.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Very good. What do you think, Tabby? Acceptable?
Absolutely. I'd be all over it.
Very good. So thank you to all of you for listening. Thank you to all of you, as always, for your support. We're going to mix things up with a future bonus episode, aren't we?
Yeah.
Tom is due to record one without me. And then Tom and I will be reunited in a couple of weeks. Of course, we've got the Luther series. There's the Lord Byron series. There's the First Emperor of China. There's the Apollo missions. There's Disco. Jacobites is coming at some point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Native Americans, the Sioux, Lakota versus General Custer. Lots of really, really interesting subjects.
Absolutely.
So thank you to the two of you for joining me on the bonus episode.
Thank you for having us, Dominic. Yeah. The glittering company.
Ah, it has been such a joy. Whether it's been a joy for the listeners or whether it's just been grotesquely self-indulgent.
Yeah, apologies.
Could it conceivably be more self-indulgent than me and Tom? I mean... That seems unlikely.
You know, I think it may just pip it, actually.
Oh, really? Don't tell Tom that. So on that bombshell, thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you, James. Thank you, Tabby. And we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.